Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Welcome to Scare You to Sleep. I'm your host, Shelby Novak, and I'm here to tell you about some weird stuff I found on Reddit. Before I begin, I'd like to thank you for the outpouring of condolences on social media for my grandmother's passing. It was not unexpected, but it has been incredibly difficult nonetheless. I was very close to her. So thank you very, very much for your kind, kind words. Now, on to the show. So, many of you may remember that on the last Dark Reddit episode, I mentioned that I had one extra story that I excluded because I realized that it could probably be an episode all on its own. Well, here it is, and it's a murder mystery. 3 years ago, a user with the name Dad Might Not Be a Murderer posted in the subreddit RBI. RBI, for those who don't know, stands for Reddit Bureau of Investigation. Again, another subreddit that I highly recommend poking around on if you find yourself up late one night and looking for something to do. There were a total of 5 posts, so I will do a little of my normal commentary between each one, but it'll probably be pretty minimal until we get to the end. Okay, here we go. My dad might not be responsible for a murder/suicide from 2015. Bear with me as I recount to the best of my ability. I have to remain somewhat vague in some of the details in order to protect my anonymity. However, I will do my best to be as clear as possible about the series of events. Okay, phew. In September of 2015, my dad's girlfriend, Sherry, started an affair with one of his friends, Billy. Billy and my dad had been friends since high school, and I knew him well. He was nerdy and kind of weird, but he was nice enough. My dad, not surprisingly, was pretty upset about the affair, but he and Sherry were already having relationship issues, and I think he was happy to find a reason to leave her officially. I know he had a few relatively cordial run-ins with Sherry and Billy, as they all lived in the same town, but he had mostly cut them both off entirely. During this time, Sherry moved to a new house only a few streets from my dad. By Thanksgiving of 2015, my dad was roughing it a little. I think he was still kind of bummed about the affair, but he had recently been in a car accident resulting in him losing his job due to a back injury. So, additionally, he was having some money issues pending a lawsuit settlement he was waiting on. By December, he was back on the mend and in pretty good spirits. We were very close and spent a lot of time together hanging out or going to bars/concerts. At the beginning of December, at 8 a.m., my dad called me at work. We only spoke for about 10 minutes, but he was in a great mood. We had some laughs and made plans to hang out for the weekend. He mentioned very briefly that Sherry had called him about an hour earlier, but he ignored the call. I barely even remember him saying it. I got home from work that night and my phone rang. It was a family friend calling me to tell me that my dad was dead, but she didn't have any other details. I was totally shocked. I had no idea what was going on, and I was in instant denial because we just made plans. I had a million things running through my head, car accident, heart attack, etc. A few moments later, my dad's 2 brothers and my grandmother knock on my door. It was true, and my dad was dead. However, the biggest shock was that Sherry was also dead. A murder-suicide. I could hardly believe what I was hearing. To add insult to injury, Billy was the one who found their bodies at Sherry's house and was currently being interviewed by police. I took a call from one of the investigators on the scene. He mentioned that it was a cut-and-dry case. Two adults deceased, each with a gunshot wound to the head. My dad was still clutching the gun. My dad was a hunter, so I was curious about the murder weapon. To my surprise, it was a small-gauge handgun. But it wasn't my dad's. It was Sherry's. Odd, but okay. During this call, and I will never understand why he found these details necessary, but he told me that my dad and Sherry had consensual sex prior to their deaths. He also told me that there was a gap in time between the deaths, that likely my dad killed Sherry, had instant regret, considered his options, and ultimately decided to also kill himself. As I'm listening to this, I just cannot wrap my mind around any of it because it was just so out of character for my dad. And not in a I don't believe my dad could do something like this kind of way. Like a real, sincere confusion. First off, he wasn't even that depressed about the affair. They had already split up for 3 months at this point, and he was seemingly pretty happy in the wake of it all. Secondly, as I mentioned, Sherry was living in a new house. My dad didn't know this house at all, so why/how would he have ended up with her gun in her house? He had his own guns. Thirdly, I knew that she had called him that morning and he ignored the call. It doesn't feel like someone desperate to kill another person would pass up an opportunity for an interaction with that person. None of it made sense. But I had come to terms with the information I was given and trust that the police department knew what they were doing. Not to mention, I had a funeral to plan and some deep grieving to do. A few days later, I made the trip over to my dad's house to collect his belongings and settle his affairs. His house was shockingly fully on, like lights on, TV on, cat not fed, morning coffee and weed still on the coffee table, back door unlocked, etc. It was like he raced out the door really quick with full intentions on being right back. This was not the home of someone who left with the intention of never returning. I know mental illness can and will do strange things to people, but if nothing else, he would never let his cat go hungry. Yet another red flag in my mind, but I continued forth. Eventually, I was given some of his belongings from the scene of the crime by police, and my boyfriend decided to go through his phone to see if there were any signs of what might have occurred. We found that after I spoke with him, he did end up answering a call from Sherry, which was around 11 seconds long. But we also found a slew of really weird text messages. None of the texts appear to have been from my dad because one, he had terrible grammar, and two, he didn't even know how to text. I never received a text from my dad in my entire life. He had a flip phone with T9 in 2015, for God's sake. So many people reached out to me saying, "This doesn't feel right." And I agreed. I didn't feel like any of it felt right. But I had nothing of any real substance other than gut instinct to guide me, which is not enough when dealing with the police or investigators. At one point, I literally had to ask people to just stop telling me that they thought this was somehow a setup because I couldn't do anything about it, and I was starting to lose sleep over it. I was scared to death of turning into one of those people who obsess over something out of sheer denial. No one was going to take my plight seriously, and I already knew that I would be overlooked and disregarded. So, for the last 5 years, I have done nothing but stress in silence. Until now. This past Friday, I took a call from someone very close to my dad's friend group, urging me to push harder into reopening my dad's case. Recently, it has come to light that Billy is apparently a master con artist and a fraud. I guess Sherry is one of three girlfriends that Billy has found dead since 2010. This is where I need your help, Reddit. Here is the information I was given. At some point prior to my dad and Sherry's death, Billy was dating a woman whom had recently come into money. Shortly after, this woman was found dead at the bottom of her stairs. Around that time, Billy started his affair with Sherry. She had recently inherited between $500,000 to $800,000 from her father passing away. Billy's current girlfriend has had organ failure since last year. She recently inherited a large sum of money, and Billy found her dead last Tuesday. Now, I know she was already sick, but the rumor is that she pleaded for medical help for days, and I guess he basically let her suffer. I also found out that Billy took photos of my dad and Sherry's bodies before he bothered to call the police. Why? He later showed these photos to his young daughter, double why. He has also told the story of how he found the bodies numerous times to the same person, yet the story has been told in three different ways. Did he take the photos as some sick trophy, or did he take the photos to be able to maintain his narrative? Upon learning this information, I kept thinking, but why would he have to kill my dad in order to steal Sherry's money? And then it finally dawned on me today that it was so my dad could be a scapegoat. He had to use my dad to portray a crime of passion scene so he could pretend to be a victim in the whole thing. Even though he was interviewed by police, it was just an interview, not an interrogation. The investigator said it was a cut and dry scene. They would have had no motive to interrogate him because, as far as they could tell, the murderer was dead already. However, I do know there was about an hour in his timeline that day that went unaccounted for. Billy has a very high IQ. I don't think he would have been strong enough to fight my dad in hand-to-hand combat, but I very much believe he could have easily outsmarted him. My current conspiracy theory is that Billy went to Sherry's house that morning before work, had consensual sex with her, killed her, then used her phone to call my dad, which was the 7 a.m. call. My dad didn't answer the call, and Billy went to work to maintain his story. I think Billy then used his lunch break, the unaccounted for hour, and also almost identical time of my dad's death, to go back to Sherry's house where he used her phone to call my dad again. This is the 11-second call that my dad did answer that caused him to race over to Sherry's house, leaving his house in the state I found it in 2 days later. I think he tricked my dad into coming to Sherry's, where he would be caught off guard and out of his element for an attack. I also think that this could be where the gap in their deaths could be. I think Billy went back to work for the rest of the day and then found my dad and Sherry, where he took the photos and then called the police. Here's my problem. I have no idea what to do. I don't know how to reopen a closed case. I don't have any direction on who to speak with. I've tried the police department who handled my dad's case, the local FBI, and the state attorney general, and no one can even tell me who can help me with this. Do I need a private investigator? Do I need an attorney? Is this worth looking into at all? I would love to clear my dad's name and take this terrible weight off my family's shoulders once and for all. I am also fully prepared to accept that I could be wrong, but now I have to know. Any help is greatly appreciated. Edit 1. Some people have asked how Billy would have been able to financially gain from any of these women, considering he wasn't married to any of them. I do not know any intimate details of the woman who was found at the bottom of the stairs, other than she had recently come into money and that he was the one who found her. I don't know her name or how he would have benefited from her monetarily, dead or alive. However, even though there is no current confirmation of whether he did or didn't gain from her, she is still one of three women he found dead. In regards to Sherry, she was never married and never had children, so there was no one to account for her finances other than her. She was also a little flighty, and I can see him being able to easily manipulate her or just flat out steal from her openly without her noticing right away. In regards to the most recent dead girlfriend, there is actual proof that he stole at least $10,000 from her leading up to her death. Edit 2. After the recommendations of everyone, which by the way, thank you all, I have taken a few additional measures since yesterday. I have filed for the FOIA regarding all documents that I am able to obtain, and I have also reached out via email personally to the chief and deputy chief of the police department who handled the case. So that is our first My Dad Might Not Be a Murderer post. What do you think so far? It is an interesting series of events. I will say that, you know, people are capable of a lot of things. And he was grieving. He did have money issues. Again, we're going to go into the rest of the story, but at this point of the story, when I first read this, this is where I was at. I mean, I fully, at this point, think Dad could have done it. But it is really strange that Billy keeps finding his girlfriends dead. That's either really bad luck or an interesting string of coincidences that have a meaning behind them. So, let's move on. This is update in the My Dad Might Not Be Responsible for a Murder-Suicide from 2015 saga. I'm going to make this brief, as there is really not much to update. First off, I received a ton of wonderful advice and help, which was so greatly appreciated, and I wanted to take a moment to say thank you to everyone who became so involved in this. I know there are a lot of people on this sub rooting for me, so I felt I owed it to everyone to update the current state of this conspiracy. I filed for the FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, which is basically the general public's ability to gain access to certain information regarding open, closed, or cold cases. It took a while to get anything back on that inquiry, which didn't matter anyhow because it fell painfully short. I requested interviews, police reports, DNA information, gunshot residue test results, and rape kit results. Of course, I did not request crime scene photos, as I know eventually I may have to get there, but I thought by requesting what I did, I might be able to gain traction early on without having to look at pictures of my dead dad. In true fashion, the email I received back basically just said, "Sorry, no information available." It was a little vague, so I'm unsure if it meant, "Sorry, we don't have any of these documents, period," or, "Sorry, these documents are unavailable for release." Which, either way, it doesn't make me feel any better, because that means there's very little on the case overall, or that the FOIA is pretty much a bullshit way of making people think they have access to this kind of stuff, when they really don't. So, dead end there. The second course of action I took was that I personally emailed the deputy police chief from the town he lived in and just kind of introduced myself, gave him the details of my dad's case, and said, "I believe there's more information to be uncovered in this situation, and I think it would be worth your time to look into it." Shockingly, he actually responded the very same day and said he was interested in speaking with me. Now, this was over a month ago, and I have not taken the time to do this yet. There are a few reasons behind this. Number one, I did not expect to hear from him at all, let alone so fast, so I was a little underprepared, and that's my fault. Number two, I believe he is looking to speak over the phone, and I would much rather do a face-to-face sit-down. I am very articulate either way, but I want to see his face to know his reactions. I want to see him writing things down, / noting important points I bring up. I would feel like I was more heard if he could see for himself that I'm not some crazy lady calling into the police department with this wild tale. I just want to know that I'm being taken seriously. Number three, I have additional information that I'm trying to add to my portfolio before I sit down with the police. I have a printout of a screenshot from Billy's ex-wife's Facebook page where she is just smearing the hell out of him, bringing to the table pretty much the exact same questions I have, and I ran a background check on him that showcases 19 court appearances regarding collections cases, all of which abruptly stopped about a month after my dad and Sherry died. I need more because what I have just isn't enough. I am considering reaching out to Billy's ex-wife to see if she might be interested in sitting down with me. Now that I know her stance on all this, she could be a valuable asset to me. However, I am very aware that I could compromise my own safety if she declines my invitation and rats me out. I'm torn on this. Additionally, I have my dad's cell phone, and somewhere deep in the desktop archives is a very shitty recording of the guy who Billy told the three different stories about how he found my dad and Sherry's bodies, retelling their conversation. Number 4. Furthermore, I am nervous that the police will take me seriously, and once things start unfolding, it's going to turn into a shitstorm. I need to know that my mental health and personal affairs are prepared for finding out that I am totally wrong about all of this, or I'm totally right about all of this. Both are terrifying. I have been extremely busy with work. I have a crazy high-stress job, so I put a lot of this on hold intentionally because of that. I just can't manage the anarchy of this situation, plus losing my literal shit every single day at work. Once that starts to slow down, I will dive deeper back into all of this and continue to update you all. I am still happy to accept any advice moving forward from where I currently stand, or recommendations on things to add to my portfolio that I hadn't considered yet. Again, thank you all so much for going down this rabbit hole with me. I am anxious to see it through to whatever the end might be. Now, this update was met with some comments, like this one from Lucky Texan 1959. Personally, I think it is a bad idea to wait so long after you yourself had pushed the deputy sheriff, and he was, I thought, awesome to want to get with you and see what you have. I personally think it will come to nothing, but this is a great chance for you and you are blowing it. You needed to follow up on this great chance to get something done and or hear what is up, and if you can get him interested, he can make things happen and appoint someone to look into it. Once that happens, you can get moving on this. Good luck, and take care. A few people pointed out the fact that OP mentioned that they were waiting for the right time, like opening thought 5736, who had quite a lot to say. Oh my dear user, dad might not be a murderer. I just want to hug you because it's not your job to do the police's work for them. You're going way too far in trying to build something irrefutable. Not that it might not theoretically be useful in some regard, but more importantly, now is not the time for theory. You are perfecting it and re-perfecting it and re-re-perfecting it instead of delivering it. It doesn't matter how perfect it is if it doesn't make it to the right hands at the right time, or too late. Please stop making it perfect. Please make it done. I am the commenter who said reach out to the police in the new jurisdiction where the crime took place and tell them you have information. I'm that person who introduced that topic on the thread. Please, OP, call up. No, do not email. Call up the headquarters for the police in that jurisdiction, whatever office this chief sits in. Ask who to speak to make an appointment with him because he emailed you a month ago saying he wanted to talk to you. Just say it exactly like that. Hi, I emailed with Chief Finley on April 15th, and he followed up saying he would like to meet with me. Who do I speak to about setting a time and date for his request? This isn't your request, this is his request. Note the language here. Either they'll put you with his admin who will vet who you are, probably not actually making the appointment, but take down a lot of information about you and present it to him, and then call you back with a date and time, or he himself will. Good, now you have a date and time. It's 10 days from now, it's 15 days from now, it's 5 days from now, doesn't matter. That is now your real life, real world, hard deadline, absolute, and your file will be exactly and precisely whatever it will be by that point in time. Because you are going to let go of making it perfect by that date. You are going to set the date and you're going to bring what you have. And guess what? It will actually be far, far more perfect than you think. I hear so much trauma in what you're dealing with here. I hear so much pain and approach avoidance. Approach avoidance. Approach avoidance is a classic hallmark of trauma, and it's no shock whatsoever. You have been traumatized by what you've dealt with over these many years. It would be shocking if you weren't. Because what you are going to approach now and conversely avoid is, one, you are going to approach and claim pride in yourself for following through regardless of the outcome, which is outside of your control, and avoid the shame of letting this fizzle out over perfectionism and avoidance. Number two, you are going to approach and claim knowing that you did your superhuman best and that you are now handing it over to someone else, and avoid the shame of feeling like you dropped the ball by not following through. Number three, you are going to approach and claim the relief of handing this baton over to someone else because you absolutely cannot continue to carry this alone, and avoid the shame of continuing to hide with this, essentially keeping it to yourself and avoiding determinative outcomes. I'm not a therapist, but I know a thing or two about trauma, sister. Not the trauma of my father being murdered by a con man, granted, but I know what it's like to be a perfectionist, uncertain to approach and avoid, reapproach and reavoid, to spin out and try to make everything absolutely right before I take the next step, which is, in fact, avoidance of taking the next step and nothing less. To both need to hand over my trauma and pain to someone else to handle the aspects of it that they are qualified to do so, and at the same time to be completely and totally uncertain that they will even hear me out in the first place, let alone take me seriously. I get it. I do. The problem is that the only way out of this is through. The only way you get to the other side of this is by walking right the fuck right through the fiery middle of it. You can do this. Talk to at least one other person in your real life about this. Take them with you to the meeting if you can, just to literally sit in the room with you and say nothing. I did that for a friend of mine who was escaping an abusive husband. I just sat in the room and kept my mouth shut. But my mere presence made her able to follow through with the attorney's meetings, domestic violence meetings, etc. Get someone who is willing to do that for you. They don't have to be your best friend. They can be the overly concerned and extremely well-meaning lady from church. They can be your coworker, just a human body and a human presence able to silently have your back through the meeting and who can help you process, reflect on, and debrief afterwards. Which are all fancy words for being able to ask them, "So, how'd that go?" while you buy them lunch or dinner or a drink. If I knew you IRL, or hell, even though I don't know you, but if I was nearby you geographically, I would do this for you. You can do this. Number one, call tomorrow, get the admin, say that you are following up on his request to meet, explain that you want to meet in person, be willing to accept Zoom if you have to, accept the call back from either him or the admin, and set a damn date. Number two, now that you have the date, find the warm body to go with you. In that order, do not wait until you have a warm body to make the phone call, or you will never find them. They won't materialize. Set the date and then find the warm body. Number three, realize that your file is absolutely perfect as it is ever going to be right now. Realize that the true resource is you. You are the file, my friend. You are the data and the information that you share, not the paper, not the documents, not the hard drives or the flash drives. Number four, in no uncertain terms, do not be evasive with him whatsoever about any materials you have. Just come with everything. Lay it all out and leave it there. Have the meeting. Number five, and now, here's the best part. Walk away. Walk away knowing that you have honored your father and you have done the best you can by him. Walk away and know that you have honored yourself, your pain, your anger, and obligation. Walk away and leave whatever happens next in the hands of whatever deity or force or universal principle you do or don't have any belief in whatsoever. You deserve the relief. They deserve the data. You can do this. Well, dang, opening thought 5736. I know I'm going through it at the moment, but that got me a little choked up. That was a very motivating speech. You know, take with that what you will. If you are a perfectionist who has trouble moving to the next step, I might reread that speech every once in a while just to. And I don't have a murdered father who may have been in a murder-suicide. Knock on wood. You know, stranger things have happened, I guess. Gotta call my dad, I guess, and tell him not to do that. But anyway, so there are also other comments with the same kind of ring to them. Basically, you're never going to have the perfect evidence. You're never going to have a perfect docket of things to bring to the police. Just go with what you have. And I agree. I agree. At this point in our saga, as OP called it, it seems like they have enough to. I mean, I'm not a police officer, but it seems like they have enough to ask some questions at least. I mean, this is pretty suspicious. Again, that Billy keeps finding his girlfriends dead after they inherit money. So that update we just read, I forgot to say at the top, had come on May 29th, and this second update I'm about to read didn't come until August 27th of that same year, 2021. Second update in Dad Might Not Be a Murderer. All right, so the last update, a few things have happened. I reached out to Billy's ex-wife about a month ago. She was very receptive to speaking with me, but she also still has a daughter in high school that she is trying to protect, so our exchanges are rare and often at odd times. On Wednesday night, she called me at about 12:30 a.m. and we spoke for around 2 hours. She helped clear up a lot of questions, but as these things do, it created a lot more questions, unfortunately. Side note, just so everyone is clear, I am still happily answering any questions and interested in recommendations or advice. I am working with an investigative journalist, so I am starting to get the right kind of help, and she has been amazing. She will be out of town for 2 weeks, which is a bummer since we started to gain a little traction, but in the meantime, I plan to further our research in hopes that we can continue forth aggressively once she returns. Back to the phone call. Billy's wife, we'll call her Linda, is currently battling a second round of cancer, and she is very, very sick. I think she is facing some feelings of mortality and wants to get some things off her chest. She is on oxygen, and her timeline was a bit off, but I made sure to take notes throughout our whole conversation as to piece together what I could later on. Of course, before I updated here, I spent most of the day emailing the investigative journalist back and forth so she had everything before she leaves. First off, she confessed an unknown, completely out of left field thing to me. She claimed to be in love with my dad. What? Anyway, she went on and on about how she always thought he was so handsome and so fun and such a man's man. It was honestly shocking, and I have to say that this being the very first thing she decided to open up about was both a little frustrating and off-putting. Linda is a lovely lady, and I've known her since I was a kid, but I was not at all prepared for her to tell me that she had deep feelings for my dad. The first thing racing through my mind is Billy. Of course she was in love with my dad. That is probably why Billy ran off to bang my dad's girlfriend after his divorce. Linda claims that Billy was totally unaware and non-suspect of her feelings for my dad, but I am not completely convinced of this yet. Linda proceeded to give me the timeline of events from her perspective. She started with her divorce from Billy. Linda claims that she and Billy's marriage was on the rocks, circa 2010 to 2012. Unsure of the exact years currently, but around this period. She said that they decided to take a family trip to Gatlinburg to try and repair their relationship. Their daughters were 2 and 6 at the time. Linda said, as she is driving through the mountains, she and Billy begin arguing about her making a wrong turn. Billy proceeds to place his foot on her foot on the gas pedal and press it to the floor. She is desperately trying to keep the vehicle from going off the side of a cliff, and she is pressing both the foot brake and emergency brake. Finally, the car slows down. Their 6-year-old leaps from the car. Linda grabs their 2-year-old, and Billy proceeds to beat the living hell out of her on the side of a mountain with a toddler on her hip. She said a truck pulled up, pulled Billy off of her, called the police, and he spent the night in jail. They went home, and she went forward with the divorce filings. A few years later, at the time of the affair slash murder-suicide regarding my dad and Sherry, Linda recounted the way she knew the story to be true. This is where some of the details I know become foggy based upon what she knows. She claims that this particular Friday was Billy's night to pick up their daughter from daycare. She states that Billy's story is that he went to Sherry's house, found she and my dad, left in fear, immediately returned to call the police. Once the police were on the scene, Billy asked if he could leave to pick up his daughter, and the police agreed. This is strange to me. It feels like not only is it weird that the police allowed this, but even weirder that Billy didn't just pick up the phone and ask literally anyone else in the world to go pick up his daughter. At this point, Billy picks up his then 8-year-old from daycare and proceeds to tell her in graphic detail how he had just found Uncle Shane, Linda said. When Billy and their daughter entered her home, their daughter was in complete hysterics, and Billy was ranting and raving about how he didn't have anything to do with it. A few things about this. Originally, I was told Billy had photos of the crime scene and that he showed them to his daughter. He might have photos, but as far as we know, he did not show her photos. He just told her about what happened. But still, I mean, she's 8. What the hell? Also, something Linda thought was interesting about Billy's reaction is that at this point, she was only 1 or 2 people that had even spoken to him yet. No one was pointing an accusatory finger at him because no one even knew anything at this point. She just believed the way he was acting was very unusual for someone who supposedly just happened upon 2 bodies. Next, there was some clarity about the girlfriend that he found at the bottom of the stairs. I literally just heard this story for the first time back in April when I made the original post. I still do not know the date of the incident or her name, but I do know for a fact that about a year after Billy found my dad and Sherry, his then-girlfriend was found dead at the bottom of his stairs. Initially, I was under the impression that he had found her at her house, much like he did with Sherry, but the news that this happened at his house was just mind-blowing, especially considering he and Sherry lived in the same street. Basically, the same man has now found 3 dead bodies, all on the same block, within a year of each other. He was able to explain this death away by claiming she was a sloppy drunk. The investigative journalist is continuing to look more into this for me, as I have researched this in every way I know how via Google and just cannot find a thing about it. But I have heard the story confirmed by 3 separate individuals. After this incident, Linda said she just could not shake the sensation that something was wrong. So she drove down the street to the police department to plead her case. The lead investigator on my dad's case is now the deputy chief of the department. Linda spoke directly to this man, who she said could not have been more disinterested in what she was saying to him. She said he didn't necessarily act like he was against the idea of Billy doing any of this, but more along the lines of just not wanting to do anything about it. To admit that Billy is guilty in any of this would bring to light the shortcomings of his investigation in both my dad's case, as well as the situation with the woman at the bottom of the stairs. Linda said he was very quick to brush her off and send her packing, and she was very frustrated by this. This is more important for everyone familiar with this story because I actually reached out to the same officer back in April. He did agree to meet with me, but I was underprepared and wanted to make sure I had my ducks in a row. I received a ton of backlash from many of my supporters because everyone thought I missed a huge opportunity, and at the time, I was really feeling the heat from this and hated that I chickened out. Knowing what I know now, I'm glad I didn't race in there sounding like a crazy person because I would have probably been treated the same way as Linda. And finally, I got the chance to hear directly from the horse's mouth about the most recent death in March of this year, which was Billy's ex-mother-in-law, Linda's own mother. Linda told me that when she found out Billy and her mom had started a relationship 9 years after their divorce, she was blown away. In fact, her youngest daughter, now 14, mentioned that grandma would be the next dead one. Mind you, this woman was also a severe alcoholic and was very sick. I do not know that she was necessarily near death, but it is assumed that Billy withheld her medication from her, leading to her early demise. She was 75 pounds the day she died. Billy and Linda got into quite the publicized argument a few days after the mother-in-law's death, where Billy apparently exclaimed, "I let the bitch die and everything she has is mine." Linda and Billy have not spoken since this day in early April. This is about where the conversation ended. I thanked Linda for giving me all this information and I let her know how much I appreciated the time she took to help me. I also explained to her something that I wanted her to know, which is that if I'm wrong, my life does not change. My life is not altered in any way. I've already spent the last 5.5 years of the world thinking my dad is a murderous psychopath. If I'm wrong about all of this, my life is the same. However, if I am right, her world and the world of her two daughters could come crashing down around them. I told her that I have honestly dragged my feet on so much of this, because the last thing I wanted to do is to make another family endure the same, probably worse pain than me and my family have since 2015. I don't wish this on anyone, but we all deserve the truth, no matter what the truth might be. I am prepared to be wrong, but are they prepared for me to be right? She appreciated my concerns, but she more or less gave me her blessing and told me that she would like me to see this through to its entirety, and for that, I am eternally grateful. To wrap all this up, the investigative journalist that has been helping me is currently filing for an FOIA the correct way. Apparently, I either asked for the wrong things or I asked the wrong people. Regardless, she is filing it for me and will be going over everything. Today, she asked if I wanted it sent directly to me or to her, and I told her I'd prefer it to go to her because I just simply do not know what to look for. But I wanted to make sure that she notified me of anything she found interesting, whether it helped or hurt my case. As always, my feelings remain the same exact way through all this. I would do damn near anything for this whole thing to be a poorly investigated tragedy that ultimately cleared my father's name, but I am fully prepared to be wrong too. I want the truth, no matter how ugly it might be or how bad it might hurt me. Period. If I found out tomorrow that all of this was in vain and there was something that just 100% proved my dad's guilt, I will walk away from this entire dramatic soap opera and accept defeat. But I just have to know that I left no stone unturned. I'm tired of losing sleep. I'm tired of feeling guilty. I'm tired of seeing my grandmother spend her final years sad and brokenhearted. I just want better answers than I have been offered the last 5 years. So the comments of this one were a lot of speculation, which is fine. That's what comments are for, I guess. But like I said, there will be minimal commentary between these because, well, let's just let the story play out, shall we? And let's move on to the third update. And before we begin, I want to point out that the previous update that we read was from August 27th, 2021. This update is from March 31st, 2022. So this was quite a while later after the last update. Third update in the My Dad Might Not Be Responsible for a Murder-Suicide from 2015 saga. I am attaching the link to the last update I posted. You can find the link to the original post from there. Wow. Hello, everyone. So, I know this has been a whirlwind of ups and downs. Imagine living it. For everyone who is invested in my story. As always, thank you so much to those who have supported me, offered advice, offered assistance, etc. I am astounded at the positive feedback I have received since I started this last year. Also, apologies for the gaps in updates and sometimes the lack of information I have when I actually manage to update. I do my best to stay on top of translating what I know over to here, but as you can assume, I am just one 33-year-old woman doing this mostly all on my own, so not only can it become daunting to constantly revisit, but also so much changes throughout the process that I can't possibly keep every single aspect straight. This is not a situation-changing update or anything. I mainly wanted to let everyone know that I am still here, I am still grinding, and I am still doing everything in my power to get to the bottom of this. A few things. I am still working with the investigative journalist. She reached out back in December to assist me with some additional information that we could look into, and unfortunately, between my old job, starting a new job, the holidays, and some other personal issues, I was not able to get back with her until the beginning of this month. Thankfully, though, she has not lost sight of our goal, and I would be completely lost without her guidance and connections. We have recently started making some more headway towards a few unanswered questions, but as these things do, it takes time. She has involved a Freedom of Information Act expert that is helping getting us going in the right direction. Each state, city, town, department has different rules regarding this, so she can only help so much. She also involved a retired PI who has taken a special interest in my case for fun, so that is really nice. The main issue on the table is still gathering that FOIA information. I was apparently looking in all the wrong places, but she was able to track down a direct contact and a request form that I filled out and submitted yesterday. The contact is an attorney and does not work for the police department, but I already know from previous research that while this information is legally mine to have, it also creates a problem within the police department. This is because typically when information to closed cases is being reopened and looked into, that means the department will be under a certain level of critique and scrutiny if there were any shortcuts made in the investigation. As we are clearly aware, the entire case was opened and closed within 24 hours, so I am certain someone, somewhere along the line, is going to try and intervene in my search to get this. I requested any police reports, interview information, toxicology reports, and rape kit analysis results. The last request I submitted was immediately met with, "There is no information regarding this case," which was startling. However, that could have been because I used the wrong avenue to try and get it, and not necessarily because there just isn't any information. Additionally, I am on the fence about the following. Number one, I do not know if all of what I requested is just not available to me, but it may not be available at all simply because little to none of it was actually gathered in the appropriate way. Keep in mind, the town this happened in was very small. The police on the scene allowed the person who found their bodies to leave the scene. When that person did return, he was only interviewed and not interrogated, and the person's story is, "I found my girlfriend murdered by the dead dude on the couch." So, there was very little digging done outside of this by the department, because they believed they had an open and shut case. If they do not have the information because they failed to gather it, that will help me prove just how incredibly inept the investigation was. Number two, proving that a police department didn't do their job well is not going to prove my dad's innocence or help me prove his innocence. Yes, the department might be looked at poorly and I might be able to get a civil case out of it at the very least, but it will completely set me back to the very beginning of my search. If this happens, I will really be doing the legwork on my own at that point because I will be essentially trying to create my own case and gathering my own evidence. Lastly, Billy has completely disappeared. He has not paid child support on his youngest daughter since 2020, and no one has seen or heard from him at all. This includes him being absent at his eldest daughter's wedding last year. I can't decide if this is going to help or hurt me. In a way, I feel like it just further proves his guilt and shame, but I also feel like if he's gone for good, I'm up Schitt's Creek. If I have no bad guy to point a finger at, and no police department records to use against him, I have nothing at all. I will update as soon as I receive any additional information. Right now, I can go nowhere without the details from the police report, so until I get that, or know exactly what all they are willing to give me, I'm kind of at a stalemate. Side note, the only thing that keeps me pushing through all this is how good of a guy I know him to be, and I am so certain that this did not go down the way it's being pinned on him. I just went through hundreds of pictures of him last weekend, and his sincere smile and loving embraces shined through in every last one. I try to curb my personal feelings when I'm in investigative mode, but at my core, I'm just a kid who misses her daddy. I hope he knows how hard I'm working to get to the right answers. Edit already. Almost as soon as I posted this update, I received an email from the attorney regarding the FOIA. He wants to schedule a call with me this afternoon. I've reached out to the private investigator to see what I should be prepared to discuss. I did find out upon researching him that he is the attorney for the town that this happened in, so I'm not sure how that will help or hurt me. I am concerned that his best interest will be protecting the police department that he looks over, but I am hopeful that maybe he will be more interested in getting the right answers and not further protecting those who have complicated this for me. I will be going straight to my mom's before the call because I would like to record it in case he gives me bullshit. I will report back. Edit number 2. Hey y'all, so the call went pretty well. He is young and seems very intrigued by this entire tale. He made mention that this was nowhere at all on his radar and wanted to know as much as I could jam into our 20-minute call. Unfortunately, he has asked me to meet with the deputy chief next week. Conveniently, sarcasm, this is the same man who was the lead detective on my dad's case 6.5 years ago, and the second or third time he has been brought into my line of fire and did absolutely nothing to assist me. I did not make the attorney aware of this, and for the sake of the conversation, I agreed to meet with him. I also recorded the conversation to add to my portfolio. I did want to share the follow-up email that I sent him this morning to help me better explain a few of my points. Attorney, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for your time yesterday and further clarify some important topics that were either not brought up or were overshadowed during our conversation. Normally, I am a very composed and articulate person, but hopefully you understand that given the circumstances, the repeated instances that are regularly revealing themselves, and my personal attachment to the case, it starts to go off the rails once I get a little momentum. I understand that this is a complex situation, and I wanted to make a few things more clear than I was able to yesterday. First off, I am not out to conquer a police department. I am not trying to point fingers at weak investigative work, and I am not after money or popularity. I am here to seek nothing other than the truth and legitimacy. The label placed on my father has been the scarlet letter of my family for the last 6.5 years, and if this just is what it is, I am not afraid of that. The anguish and emotional toll that has plagued me since the day has already done its job of breaking and remaking me. It is pertinent that you understand who I am at my core level, which is someone who has both endured the worst trauma you could possibly fathom at only 26 years old, and at the same time managed to cremate my father, plan a funeral, wipe out an entire home, tie up all financial responsibilities tethered to him, and return to work 5 days later. I am not irrational, unreasonable, unhinged, or uneducated. I do not come from a traditionally broken home. My parents were divorced when I was 6, but co-parented wonderfully and always maintained a close friendship and good foundation for my brother and I our entire lives. And I have always had a good head on my shoulders. Again, this is more than living in denial. This is more than saying, my dad would never do something like this because he's my dad. The fact that outsiders likely see me as just a weak-minded little girl still in the throes of grief is not lost on me. I understand what I look like to literally every person not directly involved in this situation. I am more than asking for help here, I am pleading. As I stated yesterday, I am fully prepared to be wrong, and if I am, nothing changes for me personally, but if I am right, It becomes less about clearing my father's name and my conscience and more about preventing further chaos. It becomes more about stopping someone who is a potential serial killer from walking amongst the people who live in the very city that you represent and defend. It goes from being just a shocking story to surfaced reality. If nothing else, it stops someone from continuously flying under the radar and forces him to finally be held accountable for the repeated turmoil he has been linked to and personally created over the last 10 years. There are countless people who have come forward with their concerns, ranging from the various ways he's echoed the story to hearing him blatantly admit to being involved. I just want the truth, no matter what form it comes in and at whatever cost I must pay to get it. I have already followed and resolved more breadcrumbs on my own than law enforcement ever afforded me, and I won't let up until someone answers for this or it kills me, whichever comes first. Let me put it to you this way. We have two men in question here. One is labeled a murderer, and one is labeled a victim. The murderer has an ex-wife who's rallied behind his innocence since the beginning, two children he loved and adored, and an army of supporters that he's left in his wake. The victim has an ex-wife who has repeatedly tried to prove his guilt, two children that he's abandoned, zero supporters, and three dead girlfriends that he's left in his wake. Feels like a pretty easy judgment call to me. I look forward to hearing from Deputy Chief, Original Investigator, by next week sometime. If I do not, I will follow up with you by Thursday, April 7th, 2022. Thanks, and have a great weekend. Let me know what you guys think. Thanks for all your help. And we are about to go into our final update. Our fourth update. How are you feeling? Where are you at? What do you think happened? Do you need a sip of water? This has been a little long. I told you I started digging into this for that last episode and went, oop, no, this needs its own episode. And my counter at this point is at 56 minutes. So, yeah, it did need its own episode. All right. Are you ready? Here it is. Fourth and probably last update in the My Dad Might Not Be Responsible for a Murder-Suicide from 2015 saga. Oh, real quick, I forgot to update the date. This was updated on December 15th, so once again, quite a bit later than our last update. Okay, phew. So sorry to have gone off the grid for so long. I have had a whirlwind of life-changing events. My father-in-law passed away in April, my relationship of 12 years ended in July, and I have recently just celebrated the 7th anniversary of my dad's passing. So life has been both busy and hard for me lately. All right, on to what you're all here for. I know many of you are going to want to kill me for not having updated this information sooner, but I am still kind of wrapping my mind around it. So, back in April, about 2 weeks before my father-in-law passed, my mom and I met with the deputy chief, the lead investigator at the time of my dad's case. He was surprisingly very receptive, kind, and understanding. A few things that happened in this two-hour meeting were both shocking and frustrating. Number one, he sat down with my mom and I, heard our plight, and continued forward on his stance that him, his team, and their evidence, he still feels strongly that the correct judgment was made on the case. He said he understood where my head was at and definitely accepted some of my concerns surrounding Billy and the deaths of his other girlfriends. He happened to also be on the scene for the woman who fell at the bottom of the stairs and also cleared up some confusion about that for us. Of course, he said that he specifically remembered Billy from my dad's case only a few years earlier, but said that Billy was not as receptive or helpful in the case of girlfriend number two. However, he said the details I was given about girlfriend number two were not exactly correct. Yes, there was a second dead girlfriend around 2017, but he recalled a scenario where she drunkenly fell midday off her porch as the result of some sort of an aneurysm-type scenario. He said that this was universally agreed on by many at the scene, given the fact that her body was just absolutely covered in multiple unidentified party bruises, both old and new. Those who were familiar with her attested to both her drinking problem as well as her constant injuries. And from their accounts, this was an accidental death caused by the woman herself. Although the deputy chief said that he found it extremely odd that Billy was so standoffish. He said that Billy was upfront about feeling like he was going to start looking like a villain instead of a victim. Still, I am not convinced, but the DC is. He said that he definitely agreed that Billy is weird, very unlucky, and just an all-around strange dude in general. But he said he was about 80% certain that this was another circumstantial situation that Billy had found himself in, and again, he was questioned and free to go once they came to their conclusion. He said there was just not enough to go off of, and being weird isn't indicative of guilt. He was unaware of the death of girlfriend number 3, Billy's former mother-in-law that he had been sleeping with from the time that girlfriend number 2 died until number 3's death, which was ruled accidental as well, as that happened in the city and not the town DC is in, so he had no dog in that fight, but did raise an eyebrow when it was brought up, which, I don't know. It's not his jurisdiction, and there's really nothing he can do about it other than agree that it's suspicious. Number 2. Ugh, this one's the worst. I am guessing that because I have been so involved in this, DC assumed that I had grown accustomed to the details of my dad's case. But as he was pulling files around my dad's case and making copies, he tossed a manila folder on the table that, upon opening, had an 8x10 photograph of my dad, hands in his lap, in a puddle of blood, with the pistol still in his hand. My mom and I both audibly gasped. It was unreal. I still can't believe I saw that. I had done a really good job this entire time of having the luxury of assuming what the scene looked like without actually seeing it. This was the first time I had seen any photos of the crime scene at all, and it was very hard for me. It knocked so much wind out of my sails that I was pretty worthless after that. My mom carried most of the rest of the meeting for me. Number 3. I explained to DC the multiple stories that had been circulating around Billy's constant retelling of how he found the bodies. Laying down, gun on the ground, sitting up, gun in the lap, sitting up, gun beside him, etc. It almost felt pointless by then because I had just quite literally seen a color photograph of the murder weapon in my dad's hand. But since I have had a lot of time to sit on those photos, I almost feel even more strongly like it looked staged. Before, I could only assume that Billy had staged the scene to implicate my dad, but even after physically seeing what should have been the proverbial nail in the coffin, it still didn't look, I don't know, right to me. It just didn't feel like a hand would fall so uniform the way it was. I was also startled by the amount of blood in my dad's lap. I was told numerous times that there was no need for me to identify my dad's body because they could easily identify him based on his ID picture. Furthermore, the bullet didn't even leave his skull and had to be extracted prior to his cremation. So it was very startling to me that there was what I would describe as a large puddle of blood in his lap. Number 4. One good thing about all of this is that due to the semi-consistent communication that I have with Billy's ex-wife, remember, Billy and his wife have been around since I was a child, so I know them both very well. I explained to DC that he had more or less disappeared off the face of the earth. His ex-wife was recovering from cancer. He hadn't paid his child support in years. He wasn't present at his oldest daughter's wedding, etc. DC did manage to at least track him down to some extent and report him to the child support court. So his wages started being garnished, and his ex-wife finally started getting a little bit of money out of him to support the kids that he's ran out on. One semi-win in all of this. She posted a very sincere and heartfelt Facebook status about a little bird, me, doing much of the footwork to hold him accountable, and we later and privately discussed my meeting with DC. I have heard that recently, though, she has stopped receiving payments again. One more thing. For some reason, I am back on believing that Sherry's brother still had something to do with it regarding the money. I honestly still feel like he talked Billy into this with the promise of a payout on the back end. Why else would her only biological sibling not give a literal fuck about his sister's house being covered in emergency vehicles on Friday night? Something is still off there, but I can't decide what yet. Rounding this out, and I'm sure I will think of other things that I have left out and or edits to questions from comments, etc., so feel free to comment any concerns or thoughts you might have. Additionally, I am happy to upload and share any photos that were provided to me. I just don't really know what the rules about posting those kinds of things. At this rate, I don't even care if Billy finds out about this or whoever else. I'm so emotionally checked out anymore about this whole thing, I really don't know what to think anymore. Thanks for being patient with me. Life is crazy. And that, my friends, unfortunately, was the last update. OP answered a few more questions in the comments, like, who did the investigative journalist work for? She said that the investigative journalist actually worked for Oprah Magazine, and that she actually received a bunch of inquiries from Dateline and 2020, but that those people didn't provide sufficient credentials because she wanted to be careful since, you know, as stated in the initial post, these were all fake names and things to provide the, or to protect the innocent. Is that Law and Order that says that? That they changed the names to protect the innocent? Anyway, there are a few questions and answers in there. So I'm going to leave the links to all of these posts in the show notes if you'd like to click through those tonight and read through the comments a little more. But I know this episode got particularly long, so I wasn't sure if you wanted me to keep reading and going through these comments and things, but feel free to look through them yourselves. If there was anything huge, I would have let you know. Of course, someone did say, I at first thought you were just karma farming, which karma is what they call the points on Reddit, if you're not familiar. And some people, you know, do make up fake stories on Reddit to get more points. I don't know why. They're not real. You don't win a prize at the end. You can't even turn them in for like Jolly Ranchers like you can at like an arcade, but people do that. I guess for attention, I don't know, some sort of undiagnosed something or other. But this person, I loved OP's reply because the person actually said, I don't think you are because of all these updates and the detail and this and that. And someone says that, well, people do this sometimes. And she replied, I appreciate it. I have a normal page for browsing and an NSFW page. So if I was looking for karma or something to stroke my ego, I'd do it with my boobs and not my dead dad. That's for sure. LOL. So I thought that was a really fun comment. And I am going to leave this story off here. Again, please, I highly recommend, I encourage you to talk about this on social media. I'm really interested to hear what you all think. Especially, this was pretty long. I also encourage you to look through the posts yourselves and read through them, all the evidence and things. And what do you think? What do you think happened? And someone asked, you know, is there going to be a story coming out about this someday? And she said, maybe. This was, what year did I say this last update was? It was, okay, December 15th, 2022. It has been 2 years, so I'm not sure. But stranger things have happened, right? So, yeah, that was this episode of Dark Reddit. If you like this show, please consider supporting me on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. You get ad-free episodes, and $3 and up, you get bonus episodes. If you'd like to submit a story, or if you have something, you know, I've thought about this too. I guess if you find anything interesting on Reddit and you'd like me to discuss it here, feel free to send that to scarytosleep@gmail.com. Again, thank you so much for your condolences on social media. It has really, really meant a lot to me. I truly mean that. And I also, through all of this, because, you know, when the matriarch of the family passes, you get in touch with family you haven't talked to in a while. I have learned a lot more people I'm related to listen to this show than I was previously aware of. So hello, cousins. hello if you're hanging around here, or friends of cousins. I know that I've had a couple stories of people who, of family members who are like, oh, your cousin so-and-so works with someone who listens to your show. And that's awesome. That's really cool. If you ever meet one of my cousins, or just, you know, be weird. Ask people at work if they're related to me. Someday, some of you did, and some of you found out that they were. Don't do that. Don't bother your coworkers. I'm probably not related to them. So yeah, that was the. It's been quite the week. And yeah, again, welcome cousins, welcome friends of cousins, or even aunts and uncles, friends of aunts and uncles, friends of whoever. Welcome. Don't tell my grandma what I talk about on here. Don't tell my other grandma what I talk about on here. She would not approve of this show. Anyway, do you hear a noise? That's my chair. It's my chair. It makes noises, okay? It's not me. It's my chair. Just putting that out there. For this week, I did do a little baking. I made it's a Texas sheet cake, but my grandmother called it a stretch cake because her recipe actually uses some substitutions to stretch the ingredients. For instance, margarine in the frosting instead of butter, and then with the butter in the main cake. It's usually a sheet cake is usually all butter, but for the stretch cake, it's like half butter, half oil. There are a few other little things I noticed because I usually use traditional Texas sheet cake recipe. And my mom was like, can you make my mom's recipe, like her actual recipe? And I looked at it and I was like, oh, it's called a stretch cake. And then I noticed the difference in ingredients. And you know how much I love food history and things like that. So to find a little bit of food history where I didn't know I would find it by making one of my grandmother's favorite cakes was really meaningful. It was really meaningful to find that. I love things like that. I love the intuition or the invention of humans, especially when it comes to times of scarcity, and to see like something as simple as like a Texas sheet cake is a very simple recipe, and to see that there were times when, you know, things just weren't available. I mean, cocoa in itself was probably, you know, not super easy to come by. And it was just really interesting to see how they stretched those ingredients for this stretch cake. Yeah, and I think that's all for this week. I don't have much to say this week. Well, I had a lot to say, clearly. We're over an hour into this episode, but, you know, when it comes to my ramble. But, you know, this is a time of, you know, things like this, it's hard because it's a time of sadness, but it's also a time of joy because, honestly, I just feel so lucky to have had such a great lady in my life to make me who I am today, and that's all I can say. Instead of, you know, I'm incredibly sad. I'm incredibly sad. But during lately in my life with all the things I've gone through, I've really learned to look at the good in things. And the good in it is, you know, I was so lucky to have her for so long in my life. And to have, again, just someone build me into the me I am. And I think I'm pretty cool. So I think that's a good thing. All right, I'm going to go. Please go drink your water. Drink water. Make a stretch cake. Make a Texas sheet cake if you, you know, have the ingredients. A lot of people, that's one thing I like about the cake is usually you just have them on hand. Go get some sleep. Sweet dreams.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM podcast network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.